Hi, I'm Chris Lloyd, and over the next few weeks on Inside Fighting, we're going to take you inside Carl Frampton's camp ahead of one of the biggest fights of his career. He stands on the brink of joining an elite group of UK fighters and becoming a three-weight world champion, and Inside Fighting will bring you exclusive, unprecedented access in these final few weeks. We'll hear from the characters driving the Frampton machine, sparring partners, friends, family, trainers and part-time comedians Jamie Moore and Nigel Travis, and of course, plenty from the main man himself. You won't miss a beat of the build-up with us, brought to you by 32 Red. You can watch episodes on YouTube, Facebook, and keep up to speed on our Twitter and Instagram pages at Inside Fighting. Please remember to like and subscribe, and welcome to the show.
And it is a good morning into good afternoon, and a hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the final press conference ahead of... well, a night of history, Saturday's historic legacy event at the Caesars Blue Waters right here in Dubai, as the one and only Jamel Hellering defends his WBO super featherweight title against the one, the only Carl Frampton in what will be the first ever world title.
Hi, everybody. Chris here. Welcome to Fight Week. It's been a long time coming, thanks to COVID, injured hands and the like. But on Saturday night, Carl steps into the ring in Dubai to try and win yet another world title, this time in the super featherweight division against the American champion, Jamel Herring. Over the next 35 minutes or so, we'll catch up with both fighters and their teams and hear from the BBC's boxing correspondent, Mike Costello, ahead of a defining night in the desert. Carl's team went out to the UAE almost 3 weeks ago to acclimatise and to put the finishing touches to a punishing camp. And Fight Week started with some good news.
So we've just checked into the Fight Week hotel. Decent hotel. I've got a suite. Don't think the rest of the lads do. Is what it is. I noticed something. So Jamel Herring came in from, I think, a 10 or 11 hour time difference. He came in, he arrived yesterday as well, or late Saturday night. So about a 24 hour journey from wherever he came from, Colorado, I think. 24 hour journey. And the first thing he does is get off the flight and trains. Now, people are looking at that going, oh, you're amazing, this is great, you doing that. I'm looking at that thinking, the only reason you're training after a full day of travelling is because you have to. So I'm taking great confidence out of that. He then trained again the next morning as soon as he was up at like 7:30, something like that. He was out training again last night. From Saturday was my last session, so a week out from the fight. I'm going to do a little explosive session today. And then that's it. I won't train again until the weigh-in. So right now at this point, I'm conserving energy for the fight. All the training's been done. All the hard work's been done. I don't have to train. Jamel Herring continues to train. Happy days.
So before he left for that long flight to Dubai, Jamel Herring and I sat down to talk about the fight, his career before turning pro, both in the military, where he served two tours of duty in Iraq, and as a member of the United States Marine Corps. We started back at London 2012, where he was beaten by Daniil Yelusinov, who'd go on to win Olympic gold 4 years later in Rio. And I began asking him about his memories of that competition and of the Kazakh who would shatter his Olympic dream.
I knew what his resume and background was just a tad bit, but it wasn't like this. It wasn't like when you're going into the Olympics and you're worried about, you know, the Ukraine team or the Cuban team and things like that. You know, those guys who stick out very well and those type of from those countries. But I knew Kazakhstan has always had a great amateur background in recent years, at least. So I knew, like, you know, the kid was legit. And I'm actually glad to see where he's at now, because it's like, okay, it wasn't so much of a bad loss then, because, like, he's actually progressing a lot as a professional. But, yeah, I mean, like you pointed out, when you are in that Olympic environment, you do hear about, you know, the guys who are the favorites in each weight class. And it's really interesting, because then you start to really follow them. Even a lot of people don't realize there was an Olympic test run back in November of 2011. And that's when I competed against my good friend now, Josh Taylor. You know what I mean? Josh fought in that tournament. And we, since then, you know, we became, you know, good friends. And it's like, that's why I really enjoyed the amateur program, because you come across a lot of, not only just a lot of great athletes, but a lot of, you know, great individuals. So that's what I really took from the amateur program back in those days.
Yeah. And you seem, from what I've seen in interviews of you, like you keep in very close contact with a lot of the people on that Olympic team and just in the amateurs in general. And it's nice that you will grow up and have success together, because you can... You can sometimes get isolated in this sport.
Of course, because, like, you know, I was a team captain for my country and on that box team. And even till this day, I still, like you pointed out, I still keep contact with just about each and every one of those individuals, and even other guys that, you know, I may compete against or came across, you know, during my time from the international level. But because I always believe that, you know, boxing is like a small fraternity. So it was always great to, you know, to see how, you know, just as a fan, at least from my end, it's always great to see how some of these guys progressed from that period to where they're at now. And it just, you know, and it just, you know, I'm just glad to say, you know, at least, like I say, I call that individual a friend, and I still communicate with them to this day.
Yeah. And it's a special responsibility being the team captain for an event like that, because it's such a game changing platform for so many people. And it's a bookmark in your career. If you do well there, you go on. And so you remember, and I know obviously you were out in that round of 32. I think you and Marcus Brown were out early. So you still have a responsibility to your teammates as the leader and as their captain.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, even when I lost the first round of the games, but as a team captain, I made sure to be at each and every one of my teammates' competition and to watch them compete, make sure that they're set mentally, and you know, just be a real good sport about it. Because you see a lot of guys, they lose. They don't want to be bothered anymore. They, you know, they go and do their own thing. But that wasn't me. You know, that shows character, you know, from what I was doing. Like, it didn't matter if I lost. I had an obligation. I'm a team captain. So my job is to make sure that my team is prepared and they're set mentally to go into that ring.
I guess a lot of that mindset must come from your time in the Marine Corps as well, learning about leadership and learning about, you know, playing for the team.
I mean, yeah, definitely, because I would say I've been through worse. You know, I've been through worse. I've dealt with two deployments. I've lost friends. I lost family. So, you know, just being in just the sport of boxing, to me, that's just a blessing, especially at this level, even at the Olympic level. You know, as an amateur, your dream is to get to the Olympics. I achieved that. Even though, you know, so I didn't get on the podium, you know, I still carry on, you know, the rest of my life saying I was a U.S. Olympian, which is a great honor. And, you know, like I said, I'm just honored just to be around great individuals around that competed then, not just in the United States, the UK, Ireland, or wherever, because, like I said, I still communicate with some of the guys overseas, and I'm just glad to see that, you know, the growth. That's why I really like to see the growth of people, not only in the ring, but outside the ring as well. And that's why, you know, I'm just so easygoing with everyone.
I wanted to talk to you. So there's a quote by Chuck Wepner. And it says, they were asking him before the Ali fight, and he said, look, he said, if I can survive the Marines, then I'll survive Ali. Can you just give me an idea and just take me through, like, the selection process, the kind of things that you have to do and where it takes you?
I mean, even going back to basic training and boot camp is more of a mental thing. Like, I was always athletic, you know, I was always into sport. So getting through the physical aspects was never really the hard part. It was basically like they said, they break you down to build you up. So that's what I'm pretty sure that's what Chuck means. Like, you got to go through a lot of mentally challenging tasks as a Marine, especially when you put in a leadership position where other lives are depending on you. You know what I mean? So, because like I said, you never, of course, I started out as the bottom of the rankings, but you eventually you grow into a leader. But as you grow, you take on more responsibility, and that can either make you or break you. And that's why I think, in terms of boxing, just with the Olympic team, that's why it was an easy transition in terms of being the team captain, because, you know, I've dealt with, when I've been in situations where I had to make, you know, a real tough decision, and I had to, you know, follow. I had to basically not only had to follow through with that decision, but I had to, you know, make sure that the men and women that behind me are confident with that decision as well. So like Chuck said, if he could survive the Marine Corps, he could survive Ali. And the same thing with the Olympics. That's why, you know, I enjoyed, you know, my position as a team captain, because now, you know, you get into a position where you got to deal with multiple personalities as well in the Marine Corps. So, you know, I may speak with this individual on the team a certain way than I would do with this other, but at the same time, I would get to them and we will, you know, we would gel and mend very easily. And like you said, you see now, like everyone's, they're friendly with me to this day. They even, like I said, Joseph Diaz, he's in the same, we're in the same weight class today, but there's never been any real animosity or issues between us because we, you know, we still have that mutual respect and bond.
When you talk about split-second decisions, I don't think there's a sport that can punish you for sometimes making the wrong decision more than boxing. But I guess in the grand scheme of things, when you've been on deployment twice, as you say, those split-second decisions really are life and death. Can you talk me through any particular scenarios that really resonate with you? Do you ever wonder, do you ever look back and think, did I make the right decision there? Or is anything in particular that you can talk me through?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just not even myself. I've been around a lot of Marines that, you know, they made decisions that they may have regretted in the end because things had took a worse turn. And it's like one of those things where that's when the mental aspect comes in. Some take it well, some don't, and they have to live with that each and every day. And that's why when I came out with my story with dealing with PTSD because of everything that I do, and what actually got me to come forward with my own situation was listening to what Tyson Fury was dealing with as just a regular civilian, you know, and realizing that, you know, these things in life can happen to anyone. It's not just men in the military. Like, you know, Tyson was going through depression and things of that nature, but look what he's done and how he bounced back. And, you know, that's, since then, I've been doing a lot of speaking with other, you know, active duty service men and women around the country to share my story, because I feel like if I can share my story and potentially, you know, save at least one life, I'm happy with that. Sometimes, like, there's a lot of things that I've been through in my past that I wish that I can, you know, change, you know, and turn the clock backwards at times. But, you know, sometimes you got to just, you know, deal with it as best as you possibly can and continue to move forward. But the main thing I could tell people is just to eventually just learn from it and grow from it, going further.
So are you 35 now?
Yep.
Is there anything you've added to your camp in the last couple of years to help recovery, mobility, maybe that you wouldn't have had to think of 10 years ago? Because not only have you've had a long boxing career of over 10 years, you've also obviously had military service. Your body's been through a lot to this point, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, and that's why... You gotta learn how to take, but people have to better take care of themselves. Like, I think I did all my partying and everything as a Marine, you know, but like, you know, when you really want something bad, you have to make sacrifices and take things seriously. You know, like I said, like even like people, you know, of course they mentioned like me just being at super featherweight, you know, that was a lifestyle change because, like, I have a nutritionist who's here with me right now. And, you know, there's things that, of course, that I don't want to eat. There's things I wish I can't eat. But, you know, when you have a lot on the line and you have to base, I look at it like this. I got others that depend on me. So if I'm not motivated by, you know, something that I'm doing for myself, at least, you know, look at who depends on you in life and down the road, or the example you can leave on someone who's looking up to you. So that's why, you know, like I said, I'm always active, busy. I'm taking care of my body. I'm resting more. And, you know, like I said, that's all I can really ask of myself. You know, like, you don't never see me out there in the club scenes and doing this. And I think the pandemic has, you know, just me getting, when I had COVID, that basically opened my eyes to a lot, because, you know, like, I was even really struggling even after I was coming out with a negative test. My body was going through it with the point where I thought that I would never be the same again. But, you know, after... like I said, reevaluating my lifestyle a bit more, you know, like I said, I went home. I enjoyed life. I enjoyed more time with the family. I rested more. I changed my diet, and I feel 10 times better. And I'm just grateful that I'm even here in this huge opportunity. Because, like I said, I tell everyone who asks, I'm a fan of Carl Francis. I mean, just to even be mentioned with a man that's done so many great things in his career, it's humbling. You know, like I said, we, and you know, me and Carl, we may have our little jokes and everything on social media, but it's never, like, I'm glad it's never come to where it's personal, where I see we all see it. Some fighters, they get real nasty with things and they make it personal. I'm like, no, I look at it, we're just two competitive guys, you know, just trying to do the best for, you know, and stamp our name and our own legacies. But yeah, that's, but like stuff like if it wasn't for like me changing my lifestyle up in the way I handle situations, I probably never got this opportunity. I probably wouldn't even be here as a champion. So that's why, you know, I look back on things from my past to now, and I'm just, you know, I'm just grateful just to be, like, say, even sitting here speaking with you about, you know, the future and moving forward.
So talk to me about Carl. I know there's a lot of respect from you both ways. What do you think of him as a fighter? What are his strengths? What are his weaknesses?
I think he's a really good fighter. I can tell you earlier, I like, you know, what he's done in his career. Like I said, 2016 alone was a great year for his career. I mean, I remember literally trying to get home early for the quick fight, because I knew that was a big deal. Just over there was a big deal. So, you know, it had a huge impact for us over here in America as well. And for me, I just think Carl is a real slick, sharp boxer, you know, and that's why I liked him, you know, because he doesn't have that typical style that you may think of a European fighter, you know, because as you see, sometimes Americans have this thing, I don't know why, but they think that, you know, Europeans fight a certain way, but now Carl was real slick. Then you gotta also mention in with the Santa Cruz fight. Both those fights were good fights. I mean, as a fan, I really was hoping that he would get a third fight. You know what I mean? That's how much I really, you know, respect him, because I believe he deserved that respect to get a third fight with Leo Santa Cruz. And I mean, really, I think, you know, his weakness can just be maybe just, if anything, just the weight classes and the size difference. Because like I said, what I always say is where he beats me with experience, because he's been in those, you know, those big fights, you know, I may beat him in maybe the physical aspect and things of that nature, things that people point out at times. But like I said, at the end of the day, you still have to go in there with a sharp game plan and the mindset. I can't rely just on size. Like, no, that's crazy. You know, I have to still prepare for the best Carl Frampton that I can possibly imagine in my mindset. You know, I'm not looking at like I'm just going to just go in there and just bully. No, like, I mean, he has something on the line, which is history. That's kind of, you know, that's tough right there to compete with. But yeah, man, for the most part, after this, I still would like, you know, want to shake his hand, you know, just and thank him for the opportunity. And we could just move on and just, you know, and possibly be good friends going down the road. Because like I said, it's no animosity. To me, boxing is still a sport. I'm a sportsman. And like I said, I look at it as just two good guys competing against one another. And we just, you know, we have families we want to take care of that we need to provide for. And we just want to stamp our name, our own names and legacy.
Well, there's that word again, legacy. Carl has spoken plenty about what defeat would mean. Saturday would almost certainly be the last time he steps into the ring. But if he wins and becomes the first boxer from the island of Ireland to win a world title at three different weights, what will his legacy be? Here's the BBC's boxing correspondent, Mike Costello, on how he'll be viewed if he wins on Saturday. And first, his own recollections of the Jackal.
I have twin memories of the first time of being around Carl Frampton at the highest level, and it was ahead of the fight against Kiko Martinez when he won the title outdoors on the Titanic slipway, and it was an unforgettable night. I remember so much about that, but the build-up was important too. On the night, it was a freezing cold night, and Tony Bellew was commentating alongside me on 5 Live, and he turned up in a T-shirt. Even this was September, I know, but it was September in Belfast, and he wasn't quite prepared for the elements that night. But everybody forgot as soon as the first bell sounded because the heat that was generated by the crowd. But going back to the build-up to the fight, there were two elements, one before, one after, that really struck me as to just what Carl Frampton meant to the people around him. And I picked up a copy of the Belfast Telegraph on the day of the fight, and the banner headline across the front of the paper said, along the lines of, but I'm very close to word for word here, a victory for Carl Frampton tonight will be a victory for the country we all want to live in. And I thought, that is some kind of impact for one single sportsman to make across his city, across his country. And that really rammed home to me the importance of what I was about to watch that evening. I knew it was more than a boxing event, but that really rammed it home to me how important success was for somebody who was seen to be loved by everybody in his country. And then afterwards, we got a cab back to our hotel. It wasn't that far away, but as I say, it was a freezing cold night, and it was down on the slipway and difficult to get back into the centre of town, and we had a lot of equipment with us as well. And I remember getting into the taxi, and the driver said, and I know people have got loads of apocryphal taxi stories from down the years, but this is absolutely true. And he was almost complaining, but at the same time celebrating, because he'd listened to us on the radio. But also he said that the streets had been deserted for 3 hours tonight because of Carl Frampton. So he's cost me business. And I just thought there again was it was another illustration of just what kind of impact Carl Frampton could make to the people around him, as well as what he was doing globally in the sport of boxing on the night by beating Kiko Martinez. Another incredibly memorable night at the Barclays Center in New York. I remember it was a week before I traveled to the Olympics in Rio. So it was a really busy time for me. And I've got to tell you, I was looking forward to that every bit as much as going to the Olympics. I virtually went straight from one to the other. And I cover athletics at the Olympics. So I had the last appearance at the Olympics of Usain Bolt from the Brits. I had Jessica Ennis-Hill competing in the heptathlon, and Greg Rutherford was there again, Mo Farah going for gold again. So there was plenty to look forward to, but I couldn't wait to get to New York for this fight. I mean, it was the ultimate 50-50 fight. It was one of those where you go around amongst the reporters and the commentators and the pressmen generally there, and you ask, who do you think is going to win? And it comes down pretty level on either side. Many of those big fights you go to, they're often described as pick 'em in the States and 50-50s, but you ask people who are going to win and it's like 28-0. But this was one of those where people were really quite mystified as to who would come out on top. And I think a lot of those who went for Santa Cruz did so because he was almost at home. He was at least in the United States where he'd had a lot of his career. But Frampton produced a performance that night that was truly, truly special. And when he looks back on his career, and I've spoken to him about it being one of those wins that kind of gets better with time. Sometimes you need perspective when you see other results. For example, when he went on to beat Nonito Donaire. Now, I know that was at featherweight and Donaire came back down, but you see what Donaire did after that in probably the fight of the year against Naoya Inoue. And that performance of Frampton starts to look really, really special. And I remember being in the dressing room after that fight, interviewing Carl, and Nonito Donaire walked in. And as we saw in an earlier edition of this series, the camaraderie and the I'm going to use the word love between Warrington and Frampton in the dressing room afterwards, that it's much more than respect. Maybe we haven't got a word for it. If you haven't boxed, you don't know at that level. You don't know what that emotion is, that feeling is. Only they can feel it. And Donaire came in, and the rapport between him and Carl, I just left the microphone hanging there. I stopped interviewing Carl and let them speak away. And it was a bit of radio gold as these two fighting men just spoke of the respect for each other. And Donaire actually said at that time, "That's my lot at featherweight. You bleep bleeps hit too hard for me." And sure enough, he came down in weight and produced that performance against Inoue. So this wasn't a shop-worn Donaire that Carl Frampton had beat. And even in the rematch against Santa Cruz at the MGM in Las Vegas, you know, another brilliant fight and went so, so close again. I mean, I did make Santa Cruz a winner that night and a good winner, but Frampton wasn't far away, and we now know what was going on behind the scenes, and there were issues behind the scenes, so clearly his build-up was affected. But so many memorable nights, and a losing night for him as well against Josh Warrington in the Manchester Arena. That reminded me of when Carl had beaten Scott Quigg. Again, the noise that night. Now, that night was a kind of 50-50 noise. There was the Quigg constituency, and there was the Carl Frampton crew that had come over the water. But that was an amazing night, and a performance that was so measured, given the amount of the noise and what that might do to somebody on the walk to the ring. You've every right to let go and to lose all of the sense of the fight plan and you know, whatever calmness you might have had in the dressing room. You've got every right to lose that, but he didn't. And he nailed it with a superb performance against Scott Quigg. I would go so far as to say at times he outclassed Scott Quigg. And then against Josh Warrington, another one of those 50-50s in terms of the noise of the crowd. and an amazing contest. An amazing contest, which for me was won in the first couple of rounds. You know, I heard Floyd Mayweather say to me in an interview a few years ago, and it's so simple, but some of those simple statements have such an effect. And he said to me that if you win the first round, then your opponent, simple math, he said, arithmetic, your opponent's got to win 7 of the next 11. And that starts to sound like a real, real uphill climb. And in that fight, Carl, to me, lost the first 2 rounds. So you're talking about he's got to win 7 out of 10, and the pressure's really on then. But there were points in the fight where he did, you know, his pinpoint punching did work. I was surprised in the early stages how he was being beaten to the punch. But also a lesson for us all in what Carl has said here and elsewhere, that he'd expected Warrington to be a non-puncher. And yet he was surprised to be in the ring with somebody who hit harder than anybody he'd ever shared the ring with at that point. And to me, that was something that took me aback. And it made me just remind myself that when, you know, I'm watching fights and ready to dismiss someone as a non-puncher, that, you know, the fellas taking you on the chin are those who judge best. But so many great, great memories around Carl Frampton. I've worked with him as well. We had a great night at Madison Square Garden. Anthony Joshua won't thank me for saying it, but the night he lost against Andy Ruiz, Katie Taylor on the bill, and in the best women's fight I've seen against Delphine Persoon, the first fight. In between those two fights, Callum Smith knocked out Hassam and Dam with a clinical display of punching. So on that night, you saw pretty much everything you need to see from a boxing bill. And Carl, on the front foot that night, said that the decision that went Katie Taylor's way was a disgrace. You know, and he's big friends with Katie Taylor, and on the front foot. And you know, that's priceless for broadcasters, that you get somebody who's prepared to state exactly what they feel. And, you know, taking that kind of philosophy, that mentality that's made him so successful in the ring, now transferring that outside. And that's why he's been in demand and will be in such demand by those of us in the media, because he's got so much to offer with all of those experiences, good and bad.
How big a task is it that you see in Jamel Herring ahead for Carl, and what would it mean if he was victorious?
I think it's as big a challenge as any he's faced in his career because of the sheer size of Jamel Herring. I think it's going to take very close to the best performance of his career. And I'm openly going to say I don't know that that performance is still there. I have fears about the hands. The only true treatment for hands in that condition is retirement. Just don't punch anymore. And that's the only way the hands will heal. And that's a lesson I've learned down the years. But also I think at this stage of his career now, can he find that hunger to go again? Is it enough to want to be a 3-weight world champion? In my mind, that is a fantastic accolade, and I'm not going to dismiss what Duke McKenzie has done and Ricky Burns have done. But at the same time, if you look down at Carl's record and the names that are on there, you know, the Leo Santa Cruz and the Nonito Donaire, and how he's gone through 6 and 7 world title fights in a really competitive era, I think sometimes it's you judge records and resumes in a different way. I mean, certainly if he was to beat Jamel Herring, he would be, for me, the best of those 3-weight world champions. But it is going to be a giant task. It's the ultimate 50-50 for me, because I think he's more talented than Jamel Herring. But it's this case of moving up to super featherweight. The question around Herring is how strong will he be, given that he's got to fit so much into 9 stone 4. But at the same time, I do think that if you look at Carl's record, apart from the Chris Avalos fight, his world title fights have all gone the distance. So the likelihood is it's going to be a long one. And will the hands hold up all the way through? He's certainly got the ability. For me, he can win the fight on ability. But there are so many imponderables. I do genuinely think this is a 50-50 fight. And I think it's one of those that's going to be a big part of a really important time in British boxing and boxing globally, that it keeps the momentum going, that these fights are happening. And if he should win this fight, then he will go down not just as one of Ireland's greatest ever, but also one of the mainland's greatest ever as well, given having, you know, produced so many brilliant performances in both places. I think, you know, his, for me, his legacy is already secure, but it will be greatly enhanced by a win against Herring.
Well, we'll leave the final word to Carl and his team. Before we hear from the challenger, here are the thoughts of his trainers, Jamie Moore and Nigel Travis.
I visualised carrying the kid round the ring on my shoulders without a shadow of a doubt. I've done it before when he got in the way of my big event at Windsor Park. No, listen, I visualised carrying him round and him, you know, him holding his belt aloft and carrying it through the airport, you know, in Belfast home to his family and his friends over in Belfast. God willing, we'll see Carl become victorious and three-weight world champion.
I'm a featherweight. I've been a super bantamweight before, but Jamel Herring is a big guy coming down and boiling himself down into the weight, and that's how he won the title. This is going to be the night that it's caught up on Jamel Herring. We've seen it in his last performance. He wasn't brilliant. If I'd have fought him in his last performance, I was beating him and I was knocking him out. I'm expecting the best Jamel Herring there's ever been, but there's a time where there comes a point in your career where you've struggled too much. You've killed your body too much to make the weight. And I think we can see that in Jamel's recent performances. And I'm going to go right through this guy. I genuinely believe it.
I've always been into the law of attraction, the secret. And I visualise Carl pushing Herring back. I always visualise the end. I don't visualise how he gets there. I only visualise the end part. And the end part is him hurting him downstairs, switching it upstairs. He stops him with a left hook, puts him down, and then I visualise Carl stood there with a belt over his head. Doesn't really matter how he gets there, as long as the end product is Carl stood there with a belt above his head with a big smile on his face, and him walking off into the sunset with a third world title in the third weight division.
I'm genuinely so excited about spending more time with my kids and my wife. Because of boxing, I've had to sacrifice a lot of time away from my wife, away from my kids. It's been hard for them. It's been hard for Christine. And now, this stage of my life, I suppose, once I have my hand raised at the end of this fight against Jamel Herring, like once I beat this guy, I want to almost like just not be committed. I'm always committed to my family and my wife, but just dedicate like the rest of my life to them because they've given up so much for me to get to where I am. So they've always been number one for me, so I'm excited about the future for me and my family.
Well, don't forget, you can watch Frampton against Herring on Channel 5 this Saturday evening, and then on Sunday, Inside Fighting will be back on YouTube and podcast with exclusive content from behind the scenes, hopefully with Carl as the new champion of the world.